Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ron Sterney. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Trover Capital Group. We're here today appealing from the grant of summary judgment to the defendants. The district court's judgment took the position that any discussions had between the parties would automatically constitute good faith. And specifically, the district court that there was no evidence that the defendants were stringing the plaintiff along in negotiations. We respectfully disagree with the district court's findings of fact and believe that the district court did not construe the facts that we put forth in favor of the plaintiff as it was required to do. Essentially, what we're arguing about here is a portion of the LOI, which was a binding contract, meaning that if there was a termination of negotiations toward an asset purchase agreement or APA, that the defendants would be forced to pay $200,000 in a breakup fee. And the evidence that we submitted that was adduced during discovery was that, in fact, the decision maker for the defendants, Mr. Leon Simpkins, stated, "I do not want to do the deal." The evidence was also presented to the district court that the chief financial officer, Mr. Battaglia, said Simpkins didn't want to do the deal. Mesereau Financial Group, the three individuals from Mesereau Financial who were working on behalf of Simpkins, also acknowledged that Mr. Simpkins didn't want to do the deal. And last, there was evidence that there was a family meeting in which they did not want to approve the Phase 2 environmental investigation, and they didn't want to do the deal. And that was what I would characterize as direct evidence that they weren't going forward, but instead of issuing the termination letter, these continual discussions between the lawyers for Simpkins and my client continued in a circuitous fashion, with numerous memos being issued and demands and ultimatums being issued, but no real negotiations were happening. Because in negotiations, there's an exchange of positions, and there's an idea of closing that gap. The issue of bad faith is that the party doesn't act arbitrarily, capriciously, or in a manner inconsistent with the intent of the parties. This case is a diversity case. We're applying Illinois law, and the cases that I submitted in my briefs discuss examples of where the Illinois courts have found bad faith. And I think, as I outlined in the reply brief, that this court has tangled with letters of intent and expressed some consternation or difficulties, specifically in Venture Associates, explain the difficulties associated with proving bad faith. Our case is a little different because there was this provision that provided for the breakup fee, the $200,000, that was in fact binding. But the backdrop of deciding what is bad faith. Sorry.
Is the breakup fee fairly common in this type of letter of intent?
It could be because, as Justice Posner pointed out in Venture Associates, where you're going to invest a long, drawn-out process. In this case, we spent $200,000 in fees to deal like Piper alone, not including the other investigations. Yes, it's to protect the one side from investing heavily in this. And I'm already into my rebuttal time, but I wanted to make the issue or the point of with respect to the Phase 2, and I want to make that clear. From the get-go, even before the LOI was signed, we said we're going to need a Phase 2 to proceed and get financing. Mr. Gadden, after we demanded the breakup fee, issued two memos, and he said no negotiations for the APA until we do the Phase 2. But they never ordered the Phase 2. They led us to believe that they were doing the Phase 2. This is a de facto termination of negotiations because they said no more talk about an APA until we do the Phase 2. Meanwhile, they weren't doing the Phase 2. And in our briefs and in the facts that were outlined to the district court, there was all this evidence that showed that they never did it. And Mr. Simpkins, after stating, "I don't want to deal with these folks," never retracted it. They don't address it. They just beat this drum of saying, "We continue negotiations." Well, under that.
The letter of intent expired, and then there were still some negotiations after that.
Right.
Isn't that sort of an unusual situation when if you're claiming the other side never wanted to do a deal in the first place? Why wouldn't they just let that deadline pass and then say, well, we're past the finish line, we don't have to do anything more?
My answer would be, I think there's emails and memos by the counsel representing the defendants that they were very shrewd and careful about showing good faith. In fact, they outright stated that they were very concerned about showing good faith. And second of all, I don't think it's atypical because if you invest $200,000 in investigating a deal and someone who is a good businessman knows that they do not want to appeal to the courts to make their business deal go through, they're going to try and do whatever they have to do to sort of resurrect the deal. And the negotiations that occurred after, in October and so forth, these were proposals that were met with a deaf ear, all different proposals. They weren't the proposal that we dealt with in the LOI, meaning financing contingency. They were cash contingencies or alternate proposals that my client was trying to use to resurrect this deal. And instead, the district court beat us with that stick and denied us the breakup fee. And it's a punishment for a businessman to try and resurrect a deal and make it go through. And I don't think that that should be the import of this type of ruling. I don't think we should be punished for continually trying to resurrect this. But what was hidden from us was the fact that Mr. Simpkins had said, I'm not doing this deal. That was hidden from us and not discovered until we proceeded with discovery. And all these other statements and discussions in between them and their decision maker saying, I'm not doing this deal. Everyone on their side of the table said, we know that you needed this phase two to get the financing. Mr. Brandt, the CPA, said it's a dog chasing its tail. Mr. Simpkins said, I'm not going to do the phase two. Everyone knew that they needed it. And I think the reason why I highlighted it quite simply is this. It shows in the most necessary fashion that they were not going to. They set up a condition in which it made it impossible for us to proceed. And one of the elements or one of the hallmarks of bad faith under Illinois law is when a party creates new and additional hurdles for the transaction. And I think that that was a hurdle that would never be overcome for this particular deal that was laid out in the LOI. And they also, on that note about creating additional terms, I would point out that in the second August memo, the 5 points memo that Mr. Gadden, the lead lawyer for the defendants, point out, he says, negotiations will not proceed until you give me a complete and unconditional release from the LOI. That, I think, in isolation shows bad faith because Illinois courts have said that when you create additional terms that weren't originally contemplated, you've committed bad faith. And here, Mr. Gadden was holding negotiations hostage until we gave him a release. So that's not nice. And the court in Schwinder versus Austin Bank, which I cited, states bad faith can be proved by violation of community standards of decency, fairness, or reasonableness. Well, in Illinois, when you tell your opponent in negotiations or counterpart, we're going to do something as part of this deal. We're going to do it. Is it okay as a matter of decency and reasonableness to tell your counterpart in contract negotiations, don't worry, this is not a term we're going to fight over, but then internally say, we're not going to do that? Is that reasonable? Not for bad faith, I would submit. And I would ask that Your Honors reverse the district court to show that this is something that needs to be considered. And then I also showed in our briefs and our facts that there is a motive involved. Shortly after the LOI is signed in early June, they discover that they have pension obligations of $45 million that will have to be paid off. There was this ISRA, ISRA statute in New Jersey that they have to submit permits to. There was this phase two inspection, which could cost almost $200,000. Contract negotiations with the union. They needed to give a 30-day notice of negotiation. And also Mr. Brandt told them that if they shut down the plants and Trover goes insolvent, Simpkins has to pay even if the deal is contemplated. Browners, I would ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Russell.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Judge Gettleman decided that summary judgment was appropriate in this case on the basis of essentially three things. First, he concluded that the record evidence made it absolutely indisputable that negotiations in some form did in fact continue into October, and that Simpkins' negotiations were conducted in good faith, at least in the sense that Simpkins harbored into October some hope, at least some hope, that some form of acceptable terms might be agreed upon. Second, Judge Gettleman concluded that there was nothing in the record from which it could rationally be inferred that despite the ongoing negotiations, Simpkins had somehow made an irrevocable decision months earlier that there were no circumstances under which Simpkins would ever sell its assets to Trevari. Now, Judge Gettleman's ruling, of course, was based on a review of the entire record, but he did make specific reference to two discrete record items, which by themselves, we think, dictate affirmance. First, he referred to an October 8th memorandum, an email, actually, from Trevari's principal to one of Simpkins' negotiators, which recapped the points the two parties had discussed at length the previous day, and recounted various proposals that Simpkins had made the previous day. Simpkins, not Trevari, to try to get the deal done. Second, the second record item to which the judge referred was a draft letter circulated internally, and I think the fact it was circulated internally is extremely important in dispelling any impression that there's some conspiracy or wink and nod going on between and among the Simpkins negotiators and personnel. A memorandum, October 9th, circulated internally by Simpkins' principal negotiator, suggesting yet additional revisions to Simpkins' negotiating position that he hoped might get the deal done. And again, with the expressed purpose, expressed in that memorandum, of trying to get the deal done. The necessary inference from these documents, we think, is that far from having attempted simply to string Trevari along until the September 30 termination date, Simpkins continued after, well after September 30, to seek some form of transaction, even if it meant lowering the acquisition price, which in fact was another alternative they discussed subsequent to September 30. Conduct that's absolutely inconsistent with any scheme on their part simply to string the deal along so that it gets scotched by virtue of the fact it doesn't close by September 30. In light of these documents and a wealth of other items of record evidence, and particularly the internal communications, as I mentioned, no rational fact finder could find that Simpkins had engaged in a ruse merely to get to September 30. A party that was doing so plainly would not have continued exploring a deal, either internally or externally, after September 30 had already come and gone.
Are you discounting the various emails that were sent out? There was an email on the 3rd of August from Barry Brandt, Stanley Jaskiewicz, forwarding email from Leon Simpkins stating, Leon just called me and said to tell you that he definitely does not want to go through with the Trevari transaction. He has intentions of operating with his children in charge. There's another email on the 6th of July. Another one on the 14th of July, yet another on the 27th, and one on September 5th, and Mr. Simpson's deposition, where he says, so you believe that you would not have a deal until a suitcase of cash was presented to you? And he answered, yeah. With all that, can you tell me, why do you say that there is just no evidence to show that they were not operating in good faith?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think that the one shred of evidence or piece of evidence which suggests that Mr. Simpkins didn't want to do a deal is, in fact, the August 2 email. I don't think the subsequent communications that you mentioned do, in fact, show that at all. Even this comment that a third party made, the Mesereau people, that Mr. Simpkins wanted Trevari to show up with a suitcase full of cash before he'd do a deal.
Wasn't it clear early on that this was going to be a deal that would be financed as opposed to one where someone would walk in with a cashier's check or a suitcase?
No, the letter of intent says that the $25 million would be paid in cash at closing. It was always to be a cash deal. The question was, where would Trevari come up with the cash? And what Simpkins did throughout was to say, we don't want to commit ourselves to doing phase twos, to lock up our company, to lock out the prospect of selling to others if Trevari can't show us that it's at least likely that it has the wherewithal to close this deal. But the letter of intent contemplated
But wasn't phase two necessary to get to a deal? Yet, at the same time, Simpkins seemed to be blocking
the Phase 2 or representing a Phase 2 was underway and not, in fact, doing something?
If Your Honor looks at the documents in the summary judgment appendix, I believe the series is 37 through 40, it makes it clear that Simpkins, particularly late in the game, said or proposed that it would do a Phase 2 prior to the finalization of the asset purchase agreement. There was never any refusal by Simpkins to do a Phase 2, but certainly late in the negotiations, to the extent they had been reluctant to do it or didn't want to do it until after closing, they relented, and the negotiators said to Trevari's negotiator, we will propose that a Phase 2, as part of an overall deal, that the Phase 2s go forward prior to the finalization of the APA, prior to closing. They relented. To the extent they had resisted the Phase 2s early on, they certainly relented. That's the nature of negotiation, and that's what happened.
But was access being provided?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Was access to premises being provided?
Well, the Phase 2s were to be conducted by Simpkins contractors. There would be access to Simpkins' own contractors, but the deal that was proposed was to be that Simpkins would contract for the Phase 2s. And, in fact, the record contains at least one proposal by a Phase 2 contractor and a memorandum from Simpkins' separate environmental counsel, who was still on the job as late as October 2nd, summarizing the proposals that had been received by Phase 2 contractors. The notion that Simpkins had made some internal decision that it would never do Phase 2s is simply not supported by the record. It was prepared to do them, if not early on in the negotiations, certainly by August and certainly into September and even into October. If you look at the two documents that Judge Gettleman relied on, there is an explicit mention in those documents of Phase 2s being conducted as a proposal that Phase 2s be conducted as part of the overall deal. So with respect to the August 2 memo, there's a few points that you can make separately about that, because we can't deny Mr. Simpkins says to his secretary, tell Mr. Brandt, one of my negotiators, that I don't want to do a deal anymore. I want the family to run the company. First, it's August 2. It's at least 3 months before negotiations, possibly as much as 4 months before negotiations ceased. Second, it was never sent to Mr. Gadden, who at that time was the principal negotiator. Third, there's no directive in that memorandum or that email telling anyone to stand down or do anything else. I think the testimony shows it was an outburst of Mr. Simpkins, who was angered by something that had happened in the course of negotiations with Trevari. Third, Mr. Gadden and Mr. Brandt, who were the two principal negotiators, although their roles varied a little bit over time, obviously didn't take that email, if they ever saw it. It was directed to Mr. Brandt. It was not directed to Mr. Gadden, but they didn't take it, either of them, as a directive to step down and stop negotiations. They continue to negotiate. They continue to communicate with their principal, Mr. Simpkins, recommending he take various positions in the negotiations. On August 28, and this is a reference to document 53 and 55, after a communication from Gadden recommending to Leon Simpkins that he insist on 5 discrete negotiating points, Mr. Simpkins himself wrote to Trevari to emphasize the necessity of agreement on those 5 points. Mr. Simpkins entered into the negotiations to that point. Whatever he may have said or thought on August 2nd, by August 27, he's personally involved in the negotiations on the and trying to advance points that his counsel has recommended he adopt. I see my time's expired.
Not quite.
Oh, the red, excuse me. Subsequent to all this, in mid-September, early September, the record shows that Mr. Simpkins brought Mr. Brandt in to replace Mr. Gadden as the principal or lead negotiator. Why? Because Mr. Gadden wasn't making enough progress toward a deal. In light of all these facts, Your Honor, I think that it's no rational fact finder could find that all of these negotiations were simply a ruse or play acting merely to string Trevari along to September 30 to avoid the termination, paying the termination fee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Russell. Mr. Sterney.
Thank you. The October 8th memorandum is essentially the lawyers pleading with their principal to do the deal. But similar to the earlier memorandum after the August 2nd email, again, Mr. Gannon is pleading with his principal, you should do this deal. But the decision was made. If Mr. Simpkins was involved in negotiations and wanted to go through, why is his lawyer begging him to do the deal? The inference being is that that August 2nd email still stands. This notion of it being a cash deal is ridiculous. The LOI in paragraph 9F says that financing will be contemplated. In the email traffic and the letters between Mr. Brandt and Mr. Gadden, they call my client a bottom feeder. And they say specifically, it is clear that they are going to need financing to consummate this transaction, even before the LOI is signed. It's just ridiculous to characterize the record as saying that they didn't know that this was going to be a finance deal. And there's numerous citations in my brief and before the district court that talks about how they knew it. The other issue that Mr. I'm sorry, Judge, I believe I ran out of time.
I didn't finish your thought.
Okay. Mr. Brandt being brought into Mr. Simpkins put Mr. Brandt into finished negotiations, no. My client said, I am no longer talking to Mr. Gadden because my client believed that Mr. Gadden did not have the authority to negotiate this deal, which is what we still believe and was subsequently confirmed by discovery. They never rescinded that email. Your Honors, I respectfully submit that there was a question of material fact and ask that this court reverse and remand the matter back for trial before the district judge. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.